frowned at him. "Do you mean to imply, Balin, that I don't know my own ship?"
"Of course not, sir."
Layman stared at him for a moment, then nodded and patted him on the shoulder before turning back to the others. "Balin is a good man, but not the clever sort," he said in a whisper that was easily loud enough for the first mate and cook to hear. They grinned at each other behind the captain's back as Layman started toward the cabin. "Come, I will show you the way."
"It's going to be a long trip," Adina whispered beside him.
Aaron sighed, then looked toward the distant Avarest, thinking about the would-be murderers who were no doubt even now waiting on the docks. "Think it's too late to get them to take us back." Chapter 13. He woke with a start, reaching for the blades at his sides, only to have his hands come back empty. He pushed himself up from the bed and growled a curse as he slammed his head into the frame of the empty bunk above him. Belatedly, he remembered he was in the cabin Balin had led him to the night before. Sitting up carefully, rubbing his aching forehead, he tried to shake off the remnants of his dream. He'd been back in the Mermaid, watching in shock as the man Aster flung people into the ceiling, where they shattered like cheaply made puppets, without expending any apparent effort. It was just like before, only this time, he hadn't made it out. This time he'd turned to flee, and the man had been there, waiting, smiling that small, knowing smile. Aster, the man who'd put the hit on him. Aster, a man who Ko seemed to think was Milan, whoever that was. "You have something I want," he'd said. "You have something I want." Aaron turned the words over and over in his head, but he couldn't make any sense of them. After all, the only thing he owned of any worth were his blades, and though they were good steel, they didn't come close to approaching the 5,000-coin bounty the man had offered for his head. What else could he possibly have that someone would want? What else except... "Ko, are you there?" Aaron jumped in surprise as the orb appeared directly in front of his face. "I am here, Aaron." Gone was the usual playfulness of Ko's tone. Instead, she sounded tired. No, that wasn't quite right. She sounded resigned. "Ko, who is Milan?" The virtue didn't answer. "Look, Ko, I need to know. Who is he?" There was a long pause, and Aaron was beginning to think the virtue wouldn't answer when she finally spoke, though he could hear reluctance in her tone. Milan was one of Kevlane's disciples. He was tasked with gathering the essence of one of the seven virtues so that Kevlane could conduct it into the waiting vessel. "And?" Aaron asked impatiently. "Why are you so scared of him? I deserve to know after what you've put me through. Consider it payment for the free rides I've been giving you." The virtue sighed in his mind. "Fine. After Caltris and Kevlane's deaths, when the warriors of the barbarian kings burst into the chamber, Milan, like the others, was too exhausted to defend himself. While the others struggled to rise, struggled and failed to summon the power to protect themselves, Milan went mad. He cursed Caltris and Kevlane both, even as the barbarians began their bloody work. He was so consumed by his rage that he was still screaming his hate, his curses, oblivious even when they cut his throat. But you called Aster Milan. Why would you do that unless—" "Yes," Ko said. "Your thoughts are correct. Through Kevlane's ritual, the seven virtues were created. When they arose from the ashes of that mass grave, when they awoke among those smoking husks of humanity, each virtue retained some of the memories and personality of its creator."
"You were... alive?" Aaron said, stunned. "You were a person?"
"What matters," the orb answered sharply, "is that Milan was tasked with gathering the virtue of strength. It was his power that you saw in the inn."
"Fucking perfect," Aaron muttered.
"The man can toss people around like kindling, and I can, what, feel guilty? Cry a lot?" He shook his head.
"Damn Illidan and his dice both."
"It is not wise to provoke the gods," the virtue warned.
"Oh?"
he asked, as he rose from the bed and slid his blades into the sheaths at his side.
"Yeah, you're right. I wouldn't want to make him mad, would I? My luck would go to shit. Oh, wait, my luck already is shit."
Well, at least he and the others were safe on the clandestine.
The man could be the strongest person in all of Tel'rir. No doubt was. But he couldn't walk on water.
He can't, can he?
Walk on water? The Virtue asked.
Of course not.
Aaron nodded.
Good.
They sat in silence for some time as Harren digested the information.
Then,
Co, what was your name?
At first he didn't think the Virtue was going to answer.
It was not my name, she said finally.
You do not understand. I am her creation, the product of a spell that was, by some strange anomaly, invested with a portion of her personality and part of her memories. A freak accident, nothing more.
You have her memories and her personality?
Yes.
What else is there? He asked.
It seems to me that if you think like her and remember her experiences, then you may as well be her.
You know nothing, the Virtue hissed in his mind, and he recoiled as the orb flashed a deep, angry red before reverting back to its normal color.
I am not her. I am not human. I never was. Yes, I can remember pieces. I can remember the sun on her skin, but I can't remember how it felt. I can remember the barbarians, remember the bloody slaughter they reaped, and I can feel none of it, because it was not me. It is as if there is a vital part of me missing, as if they are something I read in a book. Can you imagine what that feels like?
No, he muttered. I don't guess I can.
But tell me this. If your creator knew Milan, then why were you so scared of him? After all, he's just a Virtue, right? Just a, what did you call it? A freak accident?
You still don't understand, she answered impatiently.
The Virtue of Strength is not Milan, but it does possess Milan's personality.
Aaron grunted as understanding dawned.
And Milan was insane.
Correct. Which means that if this man Astor Kalin is not mad already, he will be so soon. There is no stopping the transferring of traits between Virtue and its partner. It is Kevlane's bond.
Aaron thought of the way Astor had slapped Lucius's hired muscle in the face, nearly killing him, or the way he'd tossed people aside, breaking bones and wreaking havoc, with no more thought than a man would give to swatting a fly.
Yeah, the bastard was crazy, all right.
Suddenly a thought occurred to him, and he went rigid.
Before, you told me that there were people who hunt the Virtues.
Astor is one of those, isn't he?
Yes.
He sighed heavily.
Great.
There's still one thing I don't understand, though.
Just one? Co asked.
Very funny, he said. But in truth, he was glad to see the Virtue getting some of her humor back. It was bad enough having to share your mind with someone else. The last thing he needed was for her to become neurotic.
Two, actually. He admitted.
First, what decides who one of you lightning bugs bonds with?
We do, of course, Co said, as if he'd just asked if birds could fly.
So you picked me?
Yes.
He shook his head in amazement.
Why in the name of the gods would you do that?
The orb bobbed in the air, and despite the fact that she had no arms or shoulders to do it with, he got the distinct impression that she was shrugging.
I thought you were funny.
Aaron blinked slowly.
You ruined my career as a decent sellsword, and made me the enemy of a psychopath that can juggle people like rocks, because you thought I was funny?
Do not mock. I have existed for thousands of years, and I've found one thing to be true. A good laugh is hard to come by.
You've got to be fucking kidding me.
You shouldn't curse so much, she admonished. And no, I'm not kidding. But why don't you talk to me about it after you've lived a few thousand years?
Okay. Ignoring the fact that you're a pain in the ass, are you telling me that Milan chose Astor?
It's not Milan.
Never mind.
To answer your question,
perhaps.
Milan, as you insist on calling him, is, as I believe I mentioned, quite insane. Who can guess why he would have chosen Astor Kalin, if he did, in fact, choose him?
And if he didn't?
The Virtue paused before answering, and when she spoke, her voice was tight with worry.
If he didn't, then Astor has discovered a way of doing what even Kevlane could not, forcing the Virtues to bond with a person of his choosing. In this case, him.
Aaron frowned. Suddenly the ship's cabin felt too small. The walls seemed to be getting closer, and the air felt thick and cloying in his throat. He got dressed, threw on his weapons, and headed out the door. On the deck, the sailors were busy about their work, and few of them spared him a second glance, which was just how he liked it. The choppy waters of the night before were nowhere in evidence, and the ship skimmed across the ocean as if it were born to it. He walked to the side of the ship and looked around. The water stretched on endlessly toward every horizon. It was a disconcerting feeling. It was as if the ship and its passengers existed in a world of their own, as if the land and cities he remembered were nothing but a dream. His stomach lurched at the thought, and he closed his eyes, fighting back a wave of nausea.
"Ah, good day, sir."
He turned to see the first mate, Balin, approaching.
"What's so good about it?"
The first mate smiled and shrugged.
"The sun's shining, and we're breathing. What more could you ask for?"
The ship lurched as the sail caught more wind, and Aaron swallowed hard.
"Land for a start."
Balin grinned wider.
"A dirt foot, eh?"
Aaron frowned. "If the gods had meant for us to be in the water, they'd have given us gills." Balin barked a laugh.
"So where are your friends?"
"I don't know."
The first mate nodded and leaned in conspiratorially.
"I'd watch her close, friend. It ain't often the boys get a good-looking gal like herself on board. I'll count us lucky if every one of the damn fools don't ask her for her hand before the day's out."
Aaron squashed the sudden, unexplainable anger that welled up at the thought.
"Where's your captain?"
Balin shrugged.
"In his cabin, I expect. Sometimes days'll go by without the cap coming top deck. Other days he'll work right alongside the lads till they're gasping like fish out of water. Ain't never any telling what he'll do."
"They've got a word for that. Crazy."
The first mate's companionable demeanor vanished in an instant.
"Look, stranger," he said, his voice gruff. "You seem like an all-right sort, and you're all-right by the captain, so I won't take offense to words spoken out of ignorance. The captain's unique, sure, and he has a way of talking what will turn a man's head around backwards, but I've been with him going on 10 years, and there ain't a man breathing that I'd rather sail with."
Aaron considered this, then spat over the ship's rails, watched as it disappeared into the rushing waters below. Suddenly queasy again, he jerked his eyes away. There wasn't any use making enemies with Balin. Despite all odds, it seemed that the man really did love his captain. Apparently, Laomin wasn't the only madman on board.
"No offense meant, first mate."
The man nodded, satisfied, and his smile reappeared. He just opened his mouth to speak when footsteps sounded behind them, and someone said,
"Excuse me, sir."
They both turned and saw the cook from the night before.
"Randolph, enough of that sir business," Balin said. "Me and you shared enough water to skip the bullshit, visitors or no."
The hawk-faced man nodded, and though he smiled, Aaron could see the worry in his eyes. "Of course, Balin. Anyway, I thought you'd want to know that there's a ship following us. They're a few days behind, I'd say, but they're following us just the same. Kurt saw them from the crow's nest." The first mate shot a look at Aaron, who shrugged to cover up the cold ball of dread that had started to gather in his stomach.
"Doesn't mean they're after us, does it?"
"Big ocean," the hawk-faced man said.
"Aye," Balin grunted, studying Aaron. "Mighty big ocean. You're right there, Randolph. Well, they're a few days away. Might be they aren't nothing to do with us."
He gazed behind them thoughtfully.
"Might be."
Aaron turned to the tall, thin man. "I thought your name was Hugh or Howie or something. The cook, right?" The two men shared a look and grinned before turning back to him. Balin answered, "Captain never has been much for details. Not real good with names and the like." Randolph nodded.
"Or duties."
The first mate nodded, rubbing a hand over his unshaven face.
"Right. Not much good with those either."
Aaron raised an eyebrow.
"Duties?"
Balin barked a laugh. "Randolph here has been the ship's second mate for going on 8 years." The sharp-featured man nodded seriously. "And I can't cook for shit, but don't tell the cap." Aaron watched the two men for a moment, waiting for them to laugh. When they didn't, he shook his head in amazement. It was a wonder that these men were still alive with such a captain.
"I know what you're thinking," Randolph said, "but you're wrong.
The captain gets a little confused, sure, but I'd guess he's just about the best damn sailor that ever lifted an oar. Not that he does a lot of that, mind.
Balin nodded. Me and the kid here would have been friendly with the fishes years ago if not for the cap.
Randolph took in Aaron's confused expression and smiled.
Balin means that we'd be dead. You see, lots of folks think there's not much to sailing besides tugging on ropes and drinking ourselves into a stupor when we're on land leave. But they're wrong. Not that we don't do some of that, you understand. But that's not all there is. You see, Sheza is a temperamental goddess. Why, between pirates, sea monsters, and good old-fashioned dumbassery, there's thousands of ways a man can die on the water.
Aaron frowned.
That's comforting.
The first mate barked a laugh.
Ain't nothing to worry about, friend. Not so long as the captain's here. Why, that man ain't met a pirate he couldn't outrun or outsmart, a stupid mistake he couldn't turn to his good, or a sea monster he wouldn't spit in the face of before he showed it our back end and made it eat our dust, metaphorically speaking.
Randolph nodded solemnly.
There's not a lot of dust in the ocean, he said to Aaron, by way of explanation.
Yeah, I got that.
Strange. He would have thought that the men would have been driven damn near to murder by the captain's erratic behavior and penchant for useless conversation, but instead, they seemed to trust him completely.
Maybe they just got used to it, he mused.
If that was the case,
he prayed to Sheza, mermaid goddess of sailors and boats, that he wouldn't have to spend enough time with the man to find out. He'd sooner get used to a blade in the gut than the unbalanced Parnan.
Does all of the crew feel this way about the captain?
Balin shrugged.
Couldn't say. This batch here's new.
As if reminded, he leaned away for a second.
Trim the jib, you lazy bastards! The wind's changing!
Several men rushed to the task, but Aaron noticed a few sullen looks when the first mate turned back.
Anyway, these fellas is already wet behind the ears.
Randolph laughed.
Shit, they're still shaking the dust off their boots, I'd say.
Balin grunted in agreement.
Why a new crew?
Aaron asked curiously. If the man's such a good captain, I would think that his men would want to keep working for him.
The two men's expressions grew grim, and Balin hawked and spat over the side of the ship.
High Prince Bilgarin, that's why.
A couple of months ago, the cap decided to make a rush to Baresh. It's a dangerous trip to the north. With the wars, a man never knows what he'll run into, and few are the captains that'll dare it. Bilgarin's got the place sealed up tighter than a duck's ass. I tried to talk the captain out of it. After all, the High Prince ain't exactly known for his mercy, and we both knew he wouldn't take kindly to any sailors dumb enough to test those waters. But he wouldn't hear none of it.
Balin's gaze grew distant as he recounted the memories.
I tried to tell him that it weren't worth the risk. After all, the North never has been known for its riches. Keeper, we could have made twice as much and travelled half the distance if we'd have taken the supplies to Talassia or Akron. The Talassas ain't much for fighting. Shit, they didn't even put up a fuss after their ruler Geoffrey's death, but they're all for primping. Not that Geoffrey was much different from what I hear.
Not a big ladies' man, our dearly departed prince, he said with a wink.
Nah, powders, perfumes, and silks will damn near bring a fortune there, and Ophassia's Akronese ain't much better.
Aaron frowned.
So why do it?
The two sailors glanced at each other and shrugged.
That's what I asked the captain, Balin said. I mean, what reason does a crew of smugglers have to go swimming with sharks like Bilgarin and the rest? Best not to get mixed up in it, I told him, no matter how good the payoff was. A dead man spends no coins, and that's the truth.
Aaron raised an eyebrow.
Smugglers, eh? And here I took you for a crew of simple sailors.
Balin grinned. Smuggling you and your friends, ain't we? Anyway, the captain weren't about to be dissuaded. He was clear on that.
He noticed Aaron's doubtful expression and shrugged.
Well, as clear as he ever is anyway.
Aaron considered this for a moment.
That still doesn't explain why Laomin would risk his crew and his own life on the trip.
The first mate nodded.
Right enough.
Now don't get the wrong notion, mister. A lot of times the captain's ideas sound like the craziest tavern tale the whore ever told.
He shook his head, a small smile on his face.
So crazy, at times, a man would have to have a death wish to follow him. But you know what? They always seem to work out. No matter how cracked the idea sounds, we always seem to come out the other side not just breathing,
but a damn sight richer than we was before we went in. Still, bringing goods to the Northerners sounded too much like picking sides to me. One of the best ways for a smuggler to get his full head lopped off, and I told the cap so.
The man met Aaron's gaze.
Do you know what he told me?
No, Aaron said, leaning forward, interested despite himself.
What?
The man's grin widened.
I ain't got a damn clue. Ain't you ever heard the man talk?
No, I ain't got no idea what he said. But I think I got a pretty good idea of what he meant by it. I think what the captain meant, more or less, was that, sooner or later, if a man didn't pick sides, a side was going to pick him anyway. At least this way, we got to make the decision ourselves. Still, he decided to put it to the crew, let them decide for themselves. Said he wasn't going to have no ghosts hunting him, on account of he didn't give them their fair choice. They said, shit, we said, that whatever the captain decided was good enough for us. You see, they was good lads, and we'd all heard the stories. We all knew that them folks in the north were starving, down to eating beans and boot leather, what with Belgarian ships patrolling the waters, keeping honest traders out. We ain't priests or saints, mind. About as far from it as you can get, truth be told. But it's one thing to thumb your nose at pompous nobles and their import taxes. It's another to let folks starve to death when you maybe could do something about it. The first mate shrugged, self-consciously. Not that that was all of it. Shit, probably not even most of it. The captain said we was going, and so we was going. That was all that needed to be said. So we set out, and after a while we met up with a couple of Belgarian ships. You got caught. The man grinned again. Those boys couldn't sail for shit. We split them, and put old Clandestine's nose in the wind, and left them flapping. No, we made it to Baresh, all right. Elidan weren't there. Or if he was, his Royal Highness didn't see fit to grace us with his presence. Some man by the name of Deckard brought some soldiers up, and took care of getting the food out to those as needed it. The common folk in the city and surrounding countryside. The nobles complained, of course. But any man with the eyes the gods gave him could see that the fat bastards weren't going hungry. If there's one thing to know about nobles, is that they'll always eat. Yes, sir. They bitched and moaned up a storm, but that Deckard fella weren't having none of it. He sent the bastards running like there was a sail on silk. He nodded approvingly. A good fella, that. Anyway, we made it out the port, and we were about a week out when we ran into him. Three or four of the big busters, Bulgarian's best ships, waiting on us like they knew what route we'd take. Weren't no way to get away from him, not then, and they escorted us to some backwater port I still can't remember the name of, through all of us set the cap in cells. They took him off alone. The man in charge, a real fat bastard by the name of Fritz or Ferg, I can't rightly recall, said that we was all to be questioned and then set free. I reckon we all knew it for a lie, even before the guards started leading the lads off one by one to ask their questions. Balin paused, and the silence stretched so taut that Aaron imagined he could hear it vibrating. When the first mate finally spoke, his voice was rough and slightly hoarse. A long week, that. Couldn't hear much down in that dungeon, but from time to time you could make out one of the lads screaming as those boys asked them their questions. He spat the last word and made a face as if he'd just swallowed some foul brew. I figured I was about a quarter of an hour from letting go and pissing myself like some kid sailor in his first bad blow when the cap showed up out of nowhere. One minute I was trying to keep myself from blubbering. The next, he was there at the door of the cell, holding his finger over his lips. He had a key. Gods know how he got it, and he let us out. Me and Randolph here was in the same cell. The fat man was saving the officers for last, and we followed the cap as he led us out of the dungeon, past a pair of unconscious guards. Balin sighed heavily and wiped a hairy arm across his eyes. I guess I'd like to say I thought we were coming back for the boys, but I knew better. The cap was doing all he could to get us out, sneaking us past the fat man's soldiers and out of the building. There just weren't no way to save the rest of them. And the truth is, I was too damn scared to worry about anybody but myself. He cleared his throat, roughly. Too damn scared. He paused then, his eyes reflecting the deep emotion that the memory brought. As for the boys, they had to know the score well as we did, but they didn't make a sound. Not a one.
Strange when you consider that one of them had to have told Belgarin's fat man what route we'd take. No way he would have found us otherwise. Like Randolph says, it's a big ocean. Anyway, the cap led us to some dump of an inn, fed us, and paid the owner for a week's stay. After that, he disappeared and didn't come back for days. My guess is he meant to go back for the lads, and judging by the grim look on his face when he returned, I don't guess he did too well on that score, not that I could promise you for sure. He never told me, and I never asked. Scared to, I reckon. All of it passed, that's a bit fuzzy. All I know is that somehow the cap got a crew together, not a familiar face among them. We waited till night, and we stole the clandestine back right from under the fat man's nose. He frowned then, and his eyes were suddenly blazing with anger. I hope Belgarin's got some serious questions for that bastard. I surely do. I hope he asks them hard, too. Damned hard. Aaron shook his head in stunned disbelief. He didn't know a lot of smugglers, but the ones he did know would have sold their kin into slavery if they thought they could make a profit off the deal. The thought of the crew of a smuggler ship risking their lives to feed some starving people they wouldn't know if they passed them on the street was almost more than he could fathom. As for Captain Leomin, well, if everything Balin said was true, the man was certainly more than he pretended to be. Which begged the question, why? Why the pretense of idiocy? Why risk his life to save strangers? So you came back to Avarest, he asked. To the Downs. And I left the boys, Balin said, wiping at his eyes. I don't guess I'll ever see him again. Not old Carl with his breath that smelled of shit and worse, or Jamie Wuthers, neither. He glanced back at Randolph and gave a laugh, choked with emotion. That boy caught just about every disease a woman could give a man, I reckon. Made a regular study of it. Randolph's eyes, too, were glistening with unshed tears, and he nodded before turning to Aaron. Yes, we went to Avarest. After all, the city is one of the few places left in Tilrir that's neutral, or claims to be anyway. As for the Downs, why not? What a better place for a group of wanted, hunted smugglers to run than a place where almost everyone's a criminal? What better place for us to hide from the world than in a part of it where no decent man or woman wants to look, let alone go? So you were still hiding when you came? Randolph nodded once. Yes. We'd suggested some ideas to the captain, but he hadn't really listened. He's been different of late. It's 'cause of the lads, Balin whispered. You wouldn't know it by the way he acts, but I think leaving the lads hurt the captain more than it did any of us. Randolph nodded. True. In a way, I'm glad you and your friend showed up. I was beginning to think we never would leave the Downs, that maybe the captain had decided to stay here, drinking and whoring the years away in an effort to forget about the crew he'd lost, about the men he hadn't been able to save. But when you showed up with all those papers, well, it was like the old captain came back all of a sudden. Aaron glanced over at Balin and saw that the man's eyes were watery and his jaw was working as if he were chewing on something. He guessed that the man probably hadn't cried since he was young enough to piss the bed and get away with it, but here he was barely holding it together. What did you say to a man like that? What could you say? Better maybe to say nothing at all. You could say you were sorry, Coe said in his mind, and he could hear the anger and sadness he felt at the pointlessness of it all mirrored in her voice. Sorry doesn't change anything, Firefly. The dead stay dead, and the bastards like Belgarin keep breathing. It's the way the world works. Sorry isn't enough. It's something. Aaron sighed inwardly and gripped the first mate's shoulder awkwardly. I'm sorry about your friends. Appreciate that, Balin said, snorting and wiping a hand across his eyes. I surely do. He looked embarrassedly around the ship, at the sailors busy about their business, and cleared his throat. Well, I guess I better see to this batch. Lest you all don't mind winding up stuck in the side of some damn mountain, that is. He nodded to Aaron and walked off, bawling out commands to the nearest sailors, who hurried to follow orders. When Aaron turned back to the second mate, Randolph was watching him strangely. Well, the hawk-faced man said finally, I guess I'd best be about my own business. Aaron watched him go before turning back to the ocean, to the deep blue water that stretched on into eternity, to the waves that lapped against the boat.
The sun was bright and warm against his skin, and he could just make out the sound of some water bird, with which he was unfamiliar, cawing and hooting in the distance. He sighed heavily. He felt sick, but it wasn't from the rolling of the deck underfoot anymore. An entire crew of men dead, all because of some prick noble. And what's changed? Nothing. Not one damn thing. The sun still rose, the waves still crashed, men still died, and the world grew older, not caring one way or the other. For the first time in years, he thought of the words Headmaster Cyril had told him on his first day in the orphanage. He'd been sitting in his room, crying over his parents, when the headmaster came to visit him. That was long before he'd discovered the headmaster's addiction to the musky-scented tamarang, long before he received the first of the scars that covered his back. On that first night, he'd thought the headmaster kind, even wise. The man looked like the world's best grandfather, grey-haired with a jolly face. Cyril came and sat beside him on the bed and patted his shoulder comfortingly. When he turned to look, the headmaster had been smiling. At the time, he thought the man was trying to reassure him. "Why do you weep, child?" the headmaster had asked. Sniffling, wiping at the tears and snot that were running down his face, Aaron had been unable to answer. "It is because of your parents, is it not?" the headmaster asked, his voice soft, filled with what the child Aaron, naive and too young to know the hard truths about people, about the world, took to be compassion. The old man shrugged casually then, and his smile turned sharp, cruel, the first signs of his true self. "Men die and the gods watch. It is the way of things. And do you know what the gods do when they watch, young Envelar?" Aaron had shaken his head, unable to speak past the lump in his throat. The man had grinned wider, displaying a crooked row of brown-stained teeth as he leaned closer, so close that Aaron could smell the bitter, acrid smell of the tamarang, though he'd known nothing of the herb then. He could feel the cloying, sickening warmth of the man's breath against his face. "They laugh. Men die, and the gods laugh, my son. So has it ever been. So will it ever be." The headmaster had been a cruel man, one who exulted in the perverse depravities he visited on the young girls of the orphanage, as well as the severe beatings he administered to the boys. He was a sick, evil bastard. Now he was a dead one, and what difference did that make? Those who had suffered or died under his twisted care got none of that which was taken from them back. The dead remained dead, and the girls, those girls with the dead eyes and shuffling lifeless walks, would never get their innocence back. Over the years, as the headmaster's tamarang addiction grew worse, so too did his rages and degradations. In the end, when Aaron had come for him, he'd barely had enough of his wits left to understand that he was going to die. Aaron had stood and watched as the man gasped his last breath, as his eyes glossed over with the unmistakable gaze of the dead, and he had enjoyed it. Still, the man had been right. "Men die, and the gods laugh," he muttered, as he gazed out over the endless water as it eddied indifferently in the wind. Aaron was so lost in his own dark thoughts that he had no idea anyone was behind him until he felt a hand on his arm. He whipped around and was surprised to see Adina standing there, watching him with eyes the color of the roiling water, her brow creased with worry. "Are you okay?" "Why wouldn't I be?" She shrugged. In the white, clinging silk shirt that she wore, he found that the motion did interesting things with her breasts, and all thoughts of the headmaster and the orphanage where he'd spent the last years of his childhood faded, and the sounds of those child screams stilled and grew silent. "I called your name 3 times. He coughed and forced his eyes away from the view the dress provided.
I was thinking."
"Oh?" she asked. "What about?" She smiled a small, knowing smile, and he got the impression that he may have taken too long to look up, after all. "Just some things Balin and Randolph were telling me." She raised an eyebrow curiously, and he began to retell the story the two men had told him. Adina waited silently as he did, asking few questions, but he saw the anger gather in her eyes like the first signs of darkening clouds before a thunderstorm. By the time he was finished, tears were winding their slow, meandering way down her face. "I didn't know it had gotten so bad," she said, her voice a dry, weak whisper. With Elidan gone, the people must have had nowhere to turn. Claudius is a sniveling coward, a fat buffoon who cares only about himself, but I wouldn't have expected him to let the people starve. There are plenty of farms in the north. It doesn't make any sense. She shook her head slowly, wiping at her eyes. I had no idea. A surge of anger flared through him, and although Aaron knew it wasn't fair, he couldn't stop himself. Why would you? You were too busy giving orders and living a life of luxury in your castle, just like the rest of your brothers and sisters. How could you be bothered to know that the common folk were starving to death? They're nothing but cattle to people like you anyway. She jumped as if struck and took a hasty step back. That's not true. How can you say that? How? He growled, grabbing her roughly by the arms. Because I know. That's how. My parents died because of people like you. Because of nobles. I spent the last years of my childhood getting beaten until I couldn't walk by an old bastard who loved his pipe more than his god. But that was fine, wasn't it? He sneered. He paid his taxes to your father, didn't he? He kissed all the right asses, was invited to some of the best parties. And shit, he worked wonders for the orphan population, didn't he? Taking those poor, downtrodden girls and boys off the streets. Why, the man was almost a fucking saint. Let go of me, you're hurting me, Adina gasped. But he wasn't listening. His mind was traveling back to those days so long ago, to the pain and the impotent rage that had been his constant companion. He gripped her tighter as he moved closer, so that his face was only inches from her. And hey, if he made the occasional visit to a young orphan girl's room at night, if during his nightly beatings he managed to beat some of the younger, weaker boys too badly, so badly that the next day they were just gone, disposed of like broken toys. Well, what does that matter? They're just orphans, right? Just commoners. Of course no one would ever know anyway, because no one ever fucking asks. Oh, but you nobles care, don't you? Sure, you and your friends put on your new dresses and go to dinners and talk about how you pity the common man, about how you abhor his suffering. All the while you sit on your pampered asses on fluffed pillows and cover yourselves in silk. But at least you're sorry. She tried to jerk away again, but he pulled her back with a growl. One of her arms moved, and before he knew it, she was holding a small, thin blade against his throat. I said, let go of me. He barked a harsh laugh. Or what? You'll kill me? He leaned against the blade, a feral grin splitting his face, and her eyes widened as blood welled up against his throat. Go ahead, princess, he snarled. Your kind have been killing my kind for years. Why stop now? She tried to pull away again, and this time he let her. I hate you, she observed, her voice cold and calm, despite the flush of red in her cheeks and forehead. She turned and started back toward the cabins. I'm surprised, princess, he called after her. I didn't think us commoners mattered enough to warrant anything but your pity. She stopped and stood with her back toward him for several seconds before looking back. I came to tell you that Captain Laomin has asked us to dine with him two nights from now. Her voice was as hard as iron, as cold as the icy mountains of the north. Yet he noticed that her hands were shaking. "Speaking of us," he said, "where's your other servant?" Her jaws clenched tightly, and she took a deep breath before answering. "Grail says that he wasn't made for the sea. Based on the buckets he's gone through in the past hours, I'd be inclined to agree." She turned and walked away. "What was all that about?" Ko asked in his mind. "None of your business, Firefly," he said, his eyes still locked on the door through which she'd gone. She didn't deserve that, the Virtue admonished. His smile had no humor in it. If not her, then who? Besides, in my experience, Lightning Bug, people never get what they deserve. Despite his words, he'd taken two steps toward the door the princess had disappeared through, an apology on his lips, before he realized what he was doing. He hesitated, his hand on the door, mulling over the words he would say for several moments, before her words from the night before ran through his head. "Don't try to act human now," she'd said. And that was right, wasn't it? Commoners were nothing more than ill, misbegotten beasts to her and her kind. Creatures placed on Earth to serve and amuse them, easy targets for their sick, perverse indulgences. After all, Cyril hadn't always been alone in his nighttime frolics, had he? He'd often brought friends. The same men who spoke with such eloquence about the plight of the commoner, men dressed in rich doublets and trousers, with arrogant swaggers, calculating smiles, and eyes colder than winter frost. He turned away from the door in disgust and walked away. He'd had his fill of nobles. Chapter 14. The next few days aboard the Clandestine passed uneventfully for Aaron. Adina took pains to stay as far away from him as possible, and never once did the Chamberlain venture out onto the deck, instead spending his time filling buckets as if he was getting paid to do it. As for the crew, the men were polite enough to Aaron's face, if in an off-handed, distracted sort of way. When he spoke to them, they answered, but they seemed to use as few words as possible, and always there was some urgent task that required their attention elsewhere. When they thought he wasn't looking, he saw them sizing him up as if spoiling for a fight. He wasn't much surprised. He had that effect on people. As for Captain Laomin, Aaron hadn't seen the man venture onto deck since he and the others boarded. He'd begun to think that the Parnan didn't plan on coming out of his cabin until they pulled into port, when he finally showed himself. Aaron was standing at the edge of the ship, watching the moonlight reflect off the passing water like a field of shining diamonds, as a skeleton crew of sailors saw to the ship's needs in what felt like brooding quiet. Somewhere out there, a ship was still following them, and despite the first mate's boasts of the clandestine swiftness, the ship seemed to be gaining on them, though it could have been his imagination. He was grimly wondering who would kill him first, Aster or Belgarin's men, when someone cleared their throat behind him. He turned, his hands balled into fists, expecting to find one of the sailors had finally decided to try his luck. Instead, he was surprised to see Captain Laomin standing before him. The Parnan was smiling widely, and what appeared to be small gold and silver bells twinkled in his long dark hair.
"Oh," Aaron grunted, "it's you."
Laomin smiled wider.
"It's good that you are here to tell me. I had begun to wonder. Now, if only someone would tell me what it means to be me, I would be most thankful."
Aaron frowned. "Listen, I appreciate you taking us out of the Downs, but I'm not in the best mood, and if you don't have anything to say..."
"Let us say, then, that I do have something to say," the man said, tilting his head first one way and then the other, and setting the small bells to jingling as if to punctuate his words.
Aaron sighed.
"Okay, then."
The captain grinned, saying nothing.
"Well?"
"Oh," the captain said as if surprised.
"You mean now?"
"Very well. Well, let me begin with a question for you, Aaron Invalar, formerly of the Downs. A riddle of sorts. What do all men, smugglers or kings, covet?"
"Silence."
The captain's laugh was rich and mellifluous, and despite himself, Aaron found that he had to fight back a smile.
"Money, Mr. Envalar,"
the captain whispered, as he stepped beside him and stared out to the sea.
"Men covet money. Sure, there are other passing lusts, but they soon lose their, shall we say, luster. For an old man, late in his years, even beautiful women hold little appeal. But all men, young or old, rich or poor, covet money. Even if they don't know what they would do with it if they had it. They yearn for it, in the way an alcoholic craves a drink, or a sneak thief a moonless night. Money, like power, is one of the ways in which all men are made or broken. One of the paths by which we are all tested."
"What are you talking about?" Aaron asked, realizing with surprise that he was interested in what the man had to say. Not for the first time, he was amazed by the fact that the man could speak complete nonsense, but do it in such a way that Aaron felt compelled to listen, as if he were some legendary prophet of old, instead of the insane captain of a smuggler crew.
"I am talking," Laomin said, "about 5,000 gold coins."
Aaron tensed at that. The captain's smile was still in place, but it appeared wooden now, and it didn't touch the limpid depths of his eyes.
5,000 gold coins, the exact amount that the man Aster had put on Aaron's head. He knew. Somehow the man knew about the price Aster had put on Aaron's head.
His hands drifted slowly toward the handles of the blades at his sides. How the captain had figured out didn't matter. What mattered was that he had, and that he was obviously planning on collecting.
"Reliable my ass, May," he thought.
"Relax," the captain said, his midnight gaze never leaving Aaron's. "We are two men, talking. Nothing more." He glanced around as if to make sure that none of the sailors had drifted within earshot. Still, such a sum would cause many men to act crazy. Normally such words coming from the odd Parnan would have been a cause for laughter. But Aaron had no time for humor. He was busy considering whether or not to draw his blades and slit the captain's throat. Maybe he was going to die, but he'd make damn sure that he'd have company when he walked Silence Fields. The Parnan smiled knowingly, as if he could read the sellsword's thoughts.
"Well," Aaron growled, "so you know. What do you plan to do about it?"
The captain leaned back, and the bells in his hair set to tinkling once more.
"Me?" he asked with a smile.
"Why, I'm the captain. I intend to do exactly what is best for those of us upon this vessel. We brave souls who have thrust ourselves into the mysterious depths of Shezza's playing ground, throwing caution to the winds and reservation to the waves." He gave a flourish of a silk-covered wrist. "In short, I intend to have dinner. Tomorrow night, you are, of course, going to attend?" Aaron opened his mouth to tell the man that he'd rather attend his own execution, but the Parnan had already started away, waving his long hair, whistling along to the jingles of the bells as he headed below decks.
5,000 gold coins, Aaron muttered to himself, still amazed at the sum.
It was a funny thing to realize he was worth more dead than alive. He glanced around at the sailors tending the rigging and working the lines. It could have just been his imagination, but he thought that they were glancing at him more frequently than what would be expected. And what was all that talk about men who are untested? What had that fool of a pun been trying to say? He realized with a groan that the best way to find out would be to accept the captain's invitation.
Son of a bitch.
His mood quickly growing from bad to worse, he headed below decks. Chapter 15. The following night, Aaron found himself outside the captain's cabin.
"What throw of Aladdin's dice has landed me here?" he thought miserably, and not for the first time.
Inside his head, Ko giggled, but he did his best to ignore it as he reached out and knocked. He heard grumbling from within, and the door opened upon the Parnan captain. The man was frowning.
"Yes, yes, welcome. Come in and be seated."
Aaron followed Laemin into a cabin that was at least 8 times the size of his own. The air was redolent with the smell of cooked meat and vegetables. The room, like the captain himself, was adorned with ostentatious, glaring decorations of every possible color and shape. Ornately made diamond chandeliers hung from the ceilings, and drapes of richly colored cloths hung against the wall. Interspersed between these were several mounted animal skulls, many of which he didn't recognize. A massive kingly table stood in the center of the room, and Adina sat in one of its high back chairs. Ignoring the princess's scowl, Aaron walked across the room and took a seat across from her. The captain reclined leisurely in her chair at the head of the table, draping an arm over its back.
"It is a poor, destitute time when a captain must not only open his own door to his guests, but must also serve his own food," the Parnan grumbled. "I have a mind to sit here until I wither away to a dry husk. Perhaps that would teach Balin the error of neglecting his duties."
He glanced at the princess knowingly.
"Good help is so hard to find these days.
After all, what good is a first mate if the man can't even serve dinner on time?" "I'm sure, Captain Laemin, that Balin has some good excuse for being unable to attend,"
Adina tried carefully.
Laemin rolled his eyes with a sigh.
"Oh, please. Sir,"
he began in a terribly inaccurate mimicry of Balin's thick accent,
"the lads tell me that the ship that's been following us is closing in, and I must see to it."
He snorted, an obvious attempt to shirk his duties. He shook his head in annoyance, and Aaron was thankful that the captain had at least taken the bells out of his hair. He was sure that if he'd had to listen to them jingling through the entire dinner, he would have taken his sword to the Parnan and damned the consequences.
"It's as if the man was born without any sense of decorum whatsoever," the captain exclaimed. Aaron cleared his throat. "It seems to me that evading that ship would be more important than having a servant for dinner." The captain nodded pityingly. "It is precisely because, my dear sellsword, you have never had a servant, that you would even contemplate such a statement. Forgive me, but through no fault of your own, a man without servants can't be expected to understand them. You lack experience, and therefore credibility in this particular area." He opened his mouth to tell the captain just what he could do with his experience and credibility, but the princess spoke first. "Don't let it bother you, Captain Laomin. I suspect that there are many areas in which Mr. Envelar lacks experience. Particularly," she said, shooting an angry glance at Aaron, "areas involving any type of human interaction that doesn't involve stabbing someone or hitting them over the head with a wine bottle." Aaron smiled his best, most winning smile at her. "Well, it's kind of you to say so, Princess. I find people easier to deal with when there's a blade at their throat, and I've made some of my best friends from wine bottles." "I didn't think you had any friends," she snapped back, all pretenses of decorum gone. Captain Laomin cleared his throat. "Yes, well, I am sure that we can come to some sort of agreement on that matter. As for her part, the princess is correct that men, in general, mind, are less sensitive to the human arts than the fairer sex." He resolutely ignored the scowl Aaron directed on him, and pressed on hastily with the air of a man trying to avoid a war. "As to Mr. Anvilar's point, I must agree that I, too, find men most agreeable after they've been thoroughly stabbed. Less useful, perhaps, but certainly more pliant." "Yes," Adina hissed, "and better to knock women over the heads with clubs than to imagine that they have their own opinions. Isn't that right, Aaron?" He grinned again and shrugged. "You won't get any argument from me." Her face turning a deep crimson, the princess was starting out of her seat when the captain rose. "Yes, yes," he said, as if oblivious to the argument. "Let us all have a toast." Aaron rose, smiling, and lifted his wine glass. He wondered idly whether the captain himself or the princess had poured it. If it was the latter, he suspected strongly that it would have spit in it, but he refused to let his discomfort show as he held out the glass to the captain's own. Adina's eyes narrowed at him, but after a moment, she reluctantly lifted her own glass from the table and touched it to the others. The captain let out an audible sigh of relief before he spoke. "A toast! To new friends who we pray will not be enemies, to old enemies who we pray are not friends, and to old friends who are," he glanced meaningfully at Aaron, "most certainly the worst of enemies." Aaron and the princess turned away from each other, their anger momentarily forgotten, as they tried to work out exactly what they were toasting. The captain sat his glass, now drained, down on the table. Finally Aaron shrugged and drank, and Adina followed suit. They all had just seated themselves again when there was a knock on the door. The captain let out an angry huff. "Who is it?" he shouted. The door opened, and a grim-looking Balin walked in. "Sir, sorry to disturb you, but—" "I sincerely doubt that, Balin," Laomin said, frowning. "But what is it that requires my attention so much that I must risk total and utter destruction at the hands of starvation to see it?" The first mate bowed his head in apology. "It's the ship, sir. They've caught us." "Impossible," Laomin exclaimed. "Why, they'd have to be, well, faster than us to do that." Balin blinked and nodded slowly. "Yes, sir." Laomin sighed heavily. "Well, I do suppose such a craft may exist, though I suspect it all the more likely that you drank milk before bed. You do know how it gives you strange dreams." The first mate continued, as if the captain hadn't spoke. "They say that they want us to hand over our passengers to them." He shot an apologetic look at Aaron and the princess. "The man aboard, the man that goes by the name of Aster, has promised 5,000 gold pieces to each of us in return for the three of them." "Go ahead and try it," Aaron thought. He liked the old first mate, as much as he liked anyone, that was. But the man was crazy if he thought Aaron would just be handed over for his execution, like a misbehaving child to be punished. He was just about to get out of his chair and draw his blades, when Ko spoke in his mind. "Wait,
Let's see what the captain says.
Fine, Aaron thought, but if we wind up as shark shit, you've only got yourself to blame.
The Parnan raised his eyebrow curiously.
And what is to be the consequence should we fail in this request?
Balin made a sound in his throat.
He says he'll kill us all.
Blaemon rolled his eyes.
How crass. Tell me, Balin, have we, as sailors of Shez's mighty seas, accepted these, our passengers, in good faith?
The first mate grinned widely.
Yes, sir, we have.
The captain nodded distractedly. And is it, thereby, in your personal and professional opinion, our duty to see to their safety as best as we are able, while they yet reside among the clandestine? The man nodded again.
Yes, sir, it is.
Layman stared hard at the first mate, and Aaron was sure that he saw anger flash in the Parnan's gaze. But when he spoke, his voice was as calm as ever.
Very well. It seems there is nothing left for us but to regretfully decline this Astor's offer.
Balin nodded.
Of course, sir. I will tell him that you will speak to him in a moment.
The captain snorted a laugh. And ruin a perfectly good dinner? Truly, Balin, sometimes your lack of decorum astounds me.
No, he said, shaking his head. It would be nothing short of criminal to let this meal, one which Henry sweated and toiled over, I do not doubt, go to waste.
Very well, sir. I will see to it.
The first mate bowed his head first to the captain, then to the others, before turning and walking out the door.
Curious,
Layman muttered to himself, as the door closed behind the departing first mate.
Truly curious.
He seemed to be in deep thought for a moment, before finally turning to Adina.
I wonder, princess, where is your man? Oh, what was his name? Eddard?
Grile. He is not feeling well, captain. He has been battling seasickness since we boarded the ship, and I fear that he would be poor company just now. The Parnan captain nodded slowly, rubbing a hand across his chin.
Right. Grile.
Still, it would do us quite well to have a servant present. Yes, quite well. Would you be so kind as to ask him if he would join us? The princess frowned, turning first to Aaron, then to Laomin.
Now?
Now? The captain asked, as if she'd suggested it.
Why, yes, he said, nodding thoughtfully. I think that would be for the best.
Aaron expected the princess to say no, and he was surprised to see her nodding thoughtfully.
Well, she said, I suppose it would do Grile good to get out of that room. Still, I'm not sure...
It's settled, then, Laomin said, rising.
He moved to slide Adina's chair out from behind her, and she had no choice but to stand.
I beg of you, do not be gone long, my dear, sweet lady, for we shall both be lessened by your departure.
Speak for yourself, Aaron muttered, and the princess shot him an angry look before allowing herself to be led out the door. Laomin looked down both sides of the hall before closing the door and sitting back down at the table.
There. Now we may talk freely, or at least as free as any one man ever may to another, constrained as we are by those around us.
He frowned and glanced around the room as if expecting to find someone hiding behind one of the cloth tapestries. Those who sit idly by, listening and waiting. After a moment, he turned and met Aaron's gaze. Gone was the absent-minded look Aaron had begun to associate with the man. For the first time since he'd met the captain, the Parnan appeared completely focused. Focused and troubled. For there are always those listening, waiting to see what we will say, what we will do. Do you not agree, Mr. Envelar? Aaron growled in frustration. There is a ship of men who have just threatened to kill you and your crew, and you talk gibberish? By the gods, what is the matter with you?
They do not threaten to kill all of the crew, Mr. Envelar, the captain replied calmly.
Or at least, they would not, I think. As for the crew being mine, you are wrong. They have not been mine for some weeks now, if they ever were. A possibility that I have grown to seriously doubt.
"What are you talking about?" Aaron asked.
"Of course they're your crew. You're their captain."
The Parnan revealed his bright white teeth in a humorless smile.
"And yet,"
They are not my crew.
I don't have time for this, Aaron growled as he rose from the table and started for the door.
I wonder, Mr. Envelar, have you ever had